You have dialed into Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim Priester with Tim O'Malley from Irish Illustrated. Pete Sampson of The Athletic and John Bryce of Football Scoop. It's Thursday, January 16th. I think, are all of us leaving for Atlanta tomorrow? Pete, you leaving for Atlanta tomorrow?
I am.
We're all on our way to Atlanta on Friday as Notre Dame and Ohio State continue preparation for the national championship game on Monday. Fellas, I've written about this, talked about this, been on radio shows. I'm going to stop talking for a little bit and throw it your way. Let's hear where your guys' heads are on this matchup with Ohio State. It's gone down to -8 at this point.
I think the biggest news is Jaugessa at left tackle, as reported by Molly McGrath. As Pete mentioned earlier in the week, Jaugessa was going to start. Wonder where he's going to start. That's the question. And then the only wonder is because Rocco Spindler, I assume, is going to try to play and make it through the game. I don't know if that's the best tactic or not, if he's injured, because he's going to have some troubles. But I would assume it's Spindler with Pendleton at the ready and Jaugessa there at left tackle. I don't know if it's the right call because I'm not Joe Rudolph and he knows 105% more, even though it's impossible, than we do about the offensive line, because he's managed to make this offensive line work with all the incredible challenges he's had. I guess the question is, have you weakened two positions? Jaugessa hasn't played left tackle in a while. Jaugessa is the best right guard. Probably not, right? You've probably just strengthened left tackle and weakened right guard.
That's how I see it. I think this is the best case scenario for Notre Dame, that Spindler is going to be available to go, and then you can have Jaugessa at left tackle, which, like, again, he was the number one left tackle when training camp started. And I keep going back to something Mike Denbrock told me in early August, late July, was just like, when I asked about the offensive line, he said the two guys that they were excited about were the two young tackles. And I was like, wait a minute, I only know of one of them. But he's like, no, it's Jaugessa and Wagner. Those are the two guys we're most excited about. Wagner clearly has borne that out. This is a hell of a ask for Jaugessa to start the game. But, like, I would much rather start Jaugessa than I would Tosh Baker, and then just roll with Rocco Spindler as long as I can at guard.
Yeah, I agree there with Pete and T.O. And I think first, I do want to make clear in talking with people over the last few days just how much respect and appreciation there is for Tosh Baker in the program, because obviously his career hasn't panned out like he's wanted, but he stepped up and he helped them get through that game against Penn State, and he'll be forever appreciated for that. But as they went back and looked at the tape, it became obvious all over again what Tosh's limitations are, and he just can't move well enough to be on the flank like that against elite edge presence. And certainly Penn State had those, and they scraped their way through, and Ohio State has those. And they don't want to be able to have Ohio State game plan going in against a Tosh Baker for a full four quarters. And I think that's what it boils down to in the people that I've spoken with. And so I do think that Jaugessa, it's a tough transition, but at least, again, he's got all those snaps that he played in last week's game. So it's no longer 377 days between meaningful action. It's just instead, 388 days or something since he last played tackle. But I still think that it helps Notre Dame immensely to have him back out on the left flank, and that's where they need to be. And he's a bigger, stronger presence than Anthony Knapp. He's probably not going to move as well as what Knapp was moving prior to the injury, but I still think that Notre Dame has a bigger body, a stronger body out there on its left edge now.
I think what it comes down to for me is I had said something about Baker starting the other day, and I understand the move with Jaugessa. I guess my question would be, if Spindler re-injures himself, which can easily happen because he's doing it virtually every week, do you go with Pendleton at guard, or do you move Jaugessa back to guard and go with Baker? But it sounds like they've made up their mind about Tosh Baker in this matchup. Pendleton, I mean, I think that's probably the best move. Pendleton was starting, most of the season.
He in some way has fallen out of favor, though, guys. He was replaced at left guard. He was replaced at right guard by Jaugessa when they couldn't go with Spindler. Like, he in some way has fallen out of favor, no matter what anybody says. Like that's he's no longer. True,
but it comes down to, do they want him on the field or Baker? And whether he's fallen out of favor or not, I agree that certainly happened. But it comes down to that, and so that's where they are. It's certainly not an ideal situation. This is going to be hard enough with Ashton Craig and the original starting offensive line, and now it's just that much more problematic. Other areas, guys. I guess we always talk about not walking all over our questions in the second segment, but just how you're feeling about where Notre Dame is in this matchup. And let me just throw this out, because I saw, I think it was Ryan McGee, Marty and McGee, and he said that Notre Dame had to play a perfect game. And I understand that sentiment, but I don't think that that's true. I don't want Notre Dame thinking like they have to play a perfect game. Ohio State's got to play better than they played against Texas. Notre Dame has to win certain categories, turnovers. We know that. Run the football, find ways. You know, when I say run the football, like people are asking for how many yards do they need to run for? It's not about that. It's about having a three and out. And then on your next series, it's third and two. You've got to convert that. And if that's on the ground, then you got to get it done. So it's more situational running. Ultimately, if you don't run the foot in general, if you don't run the football against Ohio State with an offense that isn't predicated upon throwing the football, you're not going to be able to win the game.
I think it's got to be close to perfect. I feel like if they played a Georgia style game, they would win by three, opposed to winning by 13, and maybe feeling like you're in control of that game. I think it's a game where they gotta be plus 1.5 in turnovers, and those have to be impactful. And like Notre Dame's done a great job this year of like when they create a turnover, they score on it. Sometimes immediately, sometimes one play later. But they got to have something like that, and they got to have something on special teams where they either steal a possession or just outright score. If we were just saying how many 50-yard touchdown drives of 50 yards or more would Notre Dame have in this game? And the over under was 1.5. I'm not sure I would bet the over on that.
On 50-yard touchdown drives.
First of all, I think 1.5 is the right line for that. And it needs to be two.
I was going to say I'd probably go with two and go over. So that, but that's a good line. I like it.
I think it needs to be two. Here's some of the working numbers that I've had. With your offense, you've got to score. I mean, where the offense just creates the yardage and scores 13 to 17 points. And then a defensive play that sets up more points, and then a special teams play that sets up more points. Can Notre Dame win this game by scoring 24 points? I think so.
Yes.
And that's why I say, I get it. And I realize Notre Dame's got to play really well. But, I mean, I think Notre Dame can make their offense, Ohio State's offense, play poorly. Now, if it's big plays, if there's a 55-yard pass and a 45-yard run for touchdowns, you've got to make Ohio State go 12 plays, 75 yards. If you don't do that, because Notre Dame's not going to be quick strike. They're not going to be able to be without a 100% Jeremiah Love, although I think he will probably be closer to that. Maybe he's the one guy that's capable of just doing something absurd and scoring. But I don't know. Can you find a way to score 24 points? If they do, I think they can win the game.
I was 27 was my number. I think Ohio State's going to be a little bit more effective offensively. There's a bunch of questions on this in the second segment that I have a few answers for how to win this game, but I don't think Love can be near 100%. It's been a week since he sprained his MCL and hurt it twice since. So he's just going to be really tough.
Closer, a little bit closer.
I mean, yeah. Cross, I think, is nowhere near it. I think that hurts a little bit. He has two tackles and like one pressure. He's just not, he's getting shoved around. It's not Howard Cross. There's a lot of things that have to go right. And so I do agree they have to play perfect. There's no such thing. They're not going to pull a LSU 1997 and play a perfect game. But I do think that the Georgia formula of the huge turnover and a big special teams play doesn't have to be the touchdown. But Pete, I agree. Like Jordan Faison's the reverse return against IU the start of the half. Like, that would be huge against Ohio State to start in plus territory or something along those lines. Moving the ball is, I just feel like you're going to need a good, you need like a player to come up here. Like, Jadarian Price has to come play if Jeremiah Love is playing at 80%. Jeremiah Love has sprained his MCL twice in six. He's nowhere near Jeremiah Love. He's gutting everything out right now and jumping off one leg. Like, you need someone to show up and make plays, because Ohio State's going to have dudes making plays. I mean, it all, for me, it all comes down to bothering Will Howard. And when Will Howard's on with those weapons, he's outstanding. When he's not, the games are close against Nebraska and Michigan and everybody else. So that's how it comes down to for me.
Yeah, and for me, it starts first and foremost with affecting Will Howard. I think that's incredibly important, and I don't think Notre Dame affected Drew Aller enough in the first half last week. I think it has to be more obvious that they're affecting Will Howard in the first half this week. I don't think this requires the level of a perfect game or perfection that it would have taken Notre Dame to win in 2018 against Clemson, or 2020 against Bama. And as good as Ohio State's offense particularly has been in the postseason, I don't want to lose sight of the fact that that's the same offense that only led Iowa 7-0 at halftime. And again, Iowa has trouble scoring on air, whether Brian Ferentz is there or not. And it only led Nebraska 14-9 through three quarters of that game. It was tied, I think, with Penn State 10-10 at the half, or maybe they were ahead 14-10 at the half and scored a field goal apiece in the third and fourth quarters against Penn State. They were held scoreless, I believe, in the first quarter against Northwestern, and they were tied 10-10 or something at the half against Michigan. So I think that you have to start first and foremost with affecting Will Howard. And to your point about Jadarian Price, now look, I will absolutely not question Jeremiah Love. I lost a lunch bet and happily did so on the Orange Bowl game, because I didn't think Jeremiah Love would have over 8.5 touches. Just candidly, that was my line that I set right before kickoff with somebody, and I guarantee you I'll get a text message from him because he listens religiously to this podcast, and he'll be gloating about winning a damn free lunch from me. But I'm glad I lost that lunch. And now I think with 12 days time from January 8th to January 20th that we can expect similar output, if not one or two more touches from Jeremiah Love, as long as he doesn't get re-injured earlier in that game. But I think that Jadarian Price has to have a moment in this game where he makes Caleb Downs miss a tackle and it turns into a huge chunk play. It doesn't mean Jadarian Price has to take it 65 yards for a touchdown, but Jadarian Price has to have a moment where he meets Caleb Downs in the alley, and instead of a 12-yard play, it becomes a 36, 44-yard play for Notre Dame, something like that. I do think Notre Dame will have more than two 50-yard scoring drives. Or I'm taking the over if it's set at 1.5. Maybe I'll bet Pete lunch so I can have a chance to.
Those are touchdown drives, by the way.
That's fine. I'll take. How about scoring? Give me the over on two scoring drives.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I mean that's what they need. That's what they need. Yeah. There's no way that's the path to victory.
And also, I want to, like, do you guys think Jeremiah Love 12 touches, 46 yards beats Ohio State?
No, but I think Aeneas Williams, right, two catches for 62 yards does.
Yes, yes, exactly. Okay.
Yeah. I don't think I'm guilty, and I didn't get to join you guys Monday for the pod because I was at the AFCA convention in Charlotte, but that is going to net some bonus coverage in advance of Monday's title game, so I'm glad for that. I don't think I did a good enough job of complimenting the work that Mike Denbrock did last week, and I thought the second half particularly – was the best half of football that Mike Denbrock probably called all season. I thought he was excellent. I thought it helped that he had Jeremiah Love out there running like an absolute madman. But the early shot that he dialed up to Aeneas Williams, some of the other plays that he took, I thought he had some design runs to Riley Leonard that came with expert timing. I thought last week was the best half of football that Mike Denbrock called all year.
Yeah. To have a 32, 36, and 54-yard passing plays, that's going to be hard to do this week. But that was
they have to do that again.
That was huge last week. All right, wrapping up segment one, we did have some interviews with players yesterday. I'm going to let you guys go first, but I'm going to talk about a brief conversation with Leonard Moore, who almost undoubtedly is going to be matched up most of the time with Jeremiah Smith. Tim, I know you read the transcripts. Pete, you were there with me. JB, I'm not sure what you've had a chance to see.
I was there with you, JB.
No, there you were. Gosh, I can't keep track of where everybody is. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, for me, and then I'll turn it over to Pete real quickly. For me, it was talking to Josh Burnham about how good this staff is at halftime adjustments. And I asked him if there was one halftime in particular this year that stood out better. And he said, honestly, the last game. We made some changes to take away stretch run from Penn State. That was significant. And he just said Marcus Freeman helped everybody reset by taking a deep breath. And he acknowledged that, like, you know, it felt like it was 20-3 or 30-3, and it was only 10-3. And so a couple of those guys mentioned just being able to take a deep breath and gain perspective at halftime last week. Riley Leonard talked about how good they are at making halftime adjustments. And he just pointed obviously to the coaches, but also said it had a lot to do with the selflessness of this football team. And then the other thing that stood out to me was Jalen Snead and Riley Leonard both talking about how dispirited they were walking across campus the week after the Northern Illinois game, with Riley Leonard even saying, like, even the professors, don't get me wrong here, it wasn't just the students. He said, even the professors, you feel it. And I was like, dang, looking for an escape. And even the professors sort of take on the feeling of the football team, and that was rough. And Jalen Snead said, we were the embarrassment of college football. It was a disgusting feeling walking across campus.
JB, yeah. You starting to get a wonder about me here? That's twice now in the last week that I said you weren't there at interviews. And
yeah, I'm just wondering what I've done to piss you off.
I still had you in my mind placed in Charlotte. My apologies, guys. Chime in, please.
I spent some time with Jaden Greyhouse. I'm always interested to sort of see like how players view their own seasons without coming across as like, it's just for the team. I am a robot. Everything is for the team. And like Jaden Greyhouse has had a weird season. And, you know, he said like the way that it's ending definitely gives him some more confidence moving into next year. He felt like the Orange Bowl was a long time coming. And I was like, yeah, I keep saying that. But, you know, it happened for him. And then, you know, we talked a little bit about the moves he put on the Penn State DBs. Like, one of them was so bad, the kid transferred to Rutgers, I think. So it was pretty impressive. And then Jalen Snead was fairly self-reflective about, this season feels like it's got some soul to it for him because of how hard it was to get to this point. And I don't think he's always been like open to talking about that, but he was a little bit more yesterday.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting reading when his response to, was it a harder road than he thought? Oh yeah.
Yeah. That was my
it was a much harder road than he thought from yeah. when he, anyway, he admitted he was a little too skinny there at linebacker. Mm-hmm. I found it interesting downstairs when they asked Jalen Snead, what stands out? What's the hard thing to stop about Ohio State's offense? Did you see this video?
Oh no, I didn't see what he say.
Well, I'll try to do my best imitation of it. I don't know. I can't think of anything.
He said, I can't really answer that. Yeah.
Really. He just couldn't come up with something, which is, I was like, wow, they're kind of, but yeah. He'll find some things I'm sure during the game, but Jalen Snead's growth for these playoffs, he's been really impactful as a pass rusher. Remember, he started the Georgia game with that tackle for loss, too. I did hear that, and you could kind of see it on film. You would never know this without hearing it, but when you look at it on film, he's the one that let Ty Warren loose when Jack Kaiser intercepted that ball. Jack Kaiser just saw Ty Warren escaping. That was not his coverage, and he ran back and picked off the pass. Yeah. Like when you know those are the things you just don't know watching on film, because someone points to Snead and Snead points to him, and then he just realizes Warren escapes and he starts chasing him afterwards. But the difference in Jalen Snead would have those plays all the time last year and earlier in the year, and now he's making big plays to go with every occasional little mistakes. But he'll have to have another big game, because there's going to be some plays made on the edge where guys like Snead and Kaiser and my man, oh man, I've been on multiple radio shows and podcasts this week, so I hope this works out. Kingston Viliamuasa is a different player than he was even in November. Yeah. He was fantastic on tape against Penn State.
He was really good against Georgia too, in only 12 snaps. I agree. I think KVA absolutely can be an X factor in this game. And I don't think we laugh about it. Jalen Snead was not being dismissive or disrespectful of the Ohio State offense. He was also asked upstairs, T.O., about what kind of special coverages they can do against Jeremiah Smith, or what within those coverages would fall to his responsibility. And he paused for a moment and just said, you know, I can't really answer that. And it was basically like, that's not my responsibility. So I think he very clearly knows what his assignments are in this game, and he's not going to be matched up on four ever. And so that's not part of the Jalen Snead game prep. Like, he obviously knows who four is and is very cognizant of the fact that he's a transcendent player. But I think for Jalen Snead, if you ask him, okay, what are your responsibilities in this game? He would try to answer that without giving away state secrets. And that's the way I interpreted that. He just, like, he's not looking real big picture about the Ohio State offense and what Notre Dame has to do. He's focused solely on what his job is. And I think when you have 11 guys out there at any given time with that mindset, it helps you have collective success.
Pete, you do not want the standard answer that they prepared you for. That was not the standard answer people prepared people for.
No, I would say, like, Jalen Snead, I'm much more concerned about him filling the right run hole against Travion Henderson than I am against Jeremiah Smith.
Absolutely.
That is a thing.
Looking to upgrade your wardrobe, founded by Notre Dame alum Gao Wang, you've seen ESQ's custom clothing on the player walk and all of your favorite players and coaches. With more than a decade of making the best bespoke clothing available, ESQ will help you look and feel your best. From a perfect fitting suit or sport coat, shirt or bomber jacket, or that perfect tuxedo for wedding season, check out esqclothing.com and book an appointment to upgrade your wardrobe today. Mention Irish Illustrated and get 10% off your entire purchase. That's esqclothing.com. Segment two is Burning Up the Boards. That's next.
Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question from Howens22. He wants us to look back instead of forward, which is not what Marcus Freeman would like right now, but the good thing is we are not on the team. What is the most impressive play of the playoff run so far, but what about the most important play?
Since we're going back, I wanted to ask you guys this. The center for Penn State was Nick Dawkins. You know who his dad is? It's Daryl Dawkins, Tim.
Oh, well, Chocolate Thunder. Nice.
Yeah, how about that?
No, I wish Penn State would have won.
Great question. I mean, there's so many plays. There are numerous plays to argue for. I'm going to argue for R.J. Oben's strip sack at the end of the first half against Georgia.
Is this most important you're doing?
Most important. You know, I mean, then you could go to Jaden Harrison, of course, expanding it to a 17-point lead. But for R.J. Oben to be the guy that makes that play when you're figuring, you know, you're figuring that okay, they're going into half at 6-3 and then had the opportunity to take that 10-point lead.
I will, you know what? I'm going to go with Jeremiah Love's touchdown run, but not the 98-yarder against IU. I'm going with the 3-yarder against Penn State, because you watch that play 100 times and you still don't know how he scored.
You're on most impressive right now, probably?
I think that's the most impressive play. But I will say, right there alongside it, I would go with Jaden Harrison's kickoff return for a touchdown, because it required expert patience, which is pretty hard to do as a kick returner when you start to see something open up. And then he had to get through a couple of arm tackles and then catch the edge and outrun everybody. So as good as Jeremiah Love's 98-yard touchdown run was, it was blocked. You can go back on film and see exactly how and why that play happened. But for me, it's Jaden Harrison and Jeremiah Love's 3-yard touchdown run.
We should have a draft for these. Then I would be left with Christian Gray's interception at the end of the Penn State.
Yeah, that I was going to say that.
You too bad I already took
argue.
It.
You certainly can argue that being the most important.
I mean, that would be up there if I had to have a, like, a sort of B-side, really impactful play, the non-fake punt, fake punt against Georgia is just like a huge middle finger to Kirby Smart. That would be high on my list too.
Yeah, my most impressive is Jeremiah Love's touchdown run against Penn State because it's the most impressive 2-yard run in the history of college football. That's my most impressive. The most important for me is actually Jaden Greathouse's touchdown because this is the only play where they were trailing. There's 4 minutes left. They're down 7 points before midfield. Drew Aller is not driving that team down for a field goal if Christian Gray doesn't pick it off. It was just kind of great that he did to set up overtime. But Jaden Greathouse's touchdown is the most important to me because I still think they could have beaten Oben's my second pick. I still think they could have beaten Georgia 13-10. They're down 24-17 to Penn State with 4 minutes left. Jaden Greathouse scores a touchdown.
Yeah, that's a good call, Tim. I think it's a really good call.
Oben's was crazy. That's nuts, man. Like, that was just the most, in terms of shock and awe.
Right.
It was like out of body experience.
The third question, most surprising. That's hands down. We have a question from Bobby 1556. How much autonomy does Riley Leonard have at the line of scrimmage? It seemed there were a handful of times versus Penn State that his outside receivers were matched up in one-on-one press coverage with no safety help. I could be wrong, but those seem like perfect opportunities to adjust the play and take a shot with the outside guy. Does Leonard have the ability to make these changes at the line? If you don't mind, I'm going to jump in because I actually asked Leonard yesterday. We've had, I can't remember which one of our subscribers that's been leading for us to use his question. I didn't have an answer for it until yesterday. And that was, you know, who makes the calls at the line of scrimmage, him or Coogan or how they go about doing it. And it sounded like he gave John, you were there, weren't you, when he responded to this. It starts with Coogan, and then ultimately Leonard has the final say on the field. And he admitted, you know, I had asked him a question after the game, and rarely do you see Riley Leonard not really accept a question very well. But it was about, you know, he was making some checks in the first half that Mike Denbrock didn't necessarily think were the best moves. And he said, he was a little uncertain in some of the run game checks in the first half. And it was a lot more decisive in the second half.
Yeah. He basically said that run game checks a lot of times originate with Pat Coogan and pass game checks originate with him. But he said he has final say on all, and he made clear, much like a coach, that when a check works, it's because of Pat Coogan, and when a check does not work, it's at the feet of Riley Leonard.
That was a great question. Go ahead, Pete.
Yeah, I was going to say, to answer the, like, why they don't do it more, it's just like they're not that good at it. If they had Jeremiah Smith or Jamar Chase, then it'd be a different story. And, like, the best part about Riley Leonard is, like, the fact that he's a true dual threat, and when you have to put another extra guy in the box, he still is often beating him in the run game. So I think they're just more effective when they think run first, even if they have one-on-one on the outside. It's not, this is not a world beating group of wide receivers, but the play Jaden Greathouse made on third down midway through the second half, like if you saw that more often, then I think, you know, Bobby 1556 would really be onto something. But like those kinds of plays have been fewer and farther between than Notre Dame probably would like.
I like the question because we all remember, everybody can find this real fast on their game tapes because people always still have their game tapes at Penn State. Remember Abdul Carter running down Riley Leonard on 3rd and 5, and we were like, that's the only defensive end that can run down Riley Leonard. Well, at the start of that play, Jordan Faison and Jaden Greathouse on 3rd and 5 have absolute 100% free access availability to throw them both the ball for a first down without blinking an eye. The corners are off and they brought 7 guys up. That's got to be a check. You don't have to be good to catch that ball. Go look at the right side, top of the screen. I cannot believe it. I didn't see it live either, so I don't blame Riley Leonard. That's a joke. But there are situations where it's not even beating someone. When they're going to outnumber you, you just got to hit that quick one.
Yeah. You know, and again, Pete, you did a good job answering the actual question that was asked here by Bobby 1556, but it's a lower percentage decision for Notre Dame. And, you know, Notre Dame's in that mode right now at this stage, especially as you go into Ohio State, that, I mean, it's about ball control. It's about possession. A lot of this is going to be about time of possession, and it's just a lower, a lower percentage decision in a game of this of that kind of magnitude last week.
From Judge Arthur Vandelay, how does Denbrock attack the Ohio State defense? Their second best defense in the country against the run at yards per carry and the best pass defense of the country. Where are the relative weaknesses and how does Notre Dame take advantage?
There aren't really relative weaknesses. I mean, I think I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you know, I think if there is a weakness anywhere on the three levels, I would choose the third level. And Caleb Downs is there and veteran Denzel Burke is there, who's a little banged up, by the way. You know, Davison Igbinosin is the most penalized cornerback in the country in with the ball in the air, whether it's a hold or interference, which I don't think is, I mean, I don't think that's by accident. It's, there are times where it's just better for him to hold than it is to get beaten. So, I mean, they've got to run. I think you've got to probably get the ball to the running backs through the air. I think you continue to do some of the stuff that you've done with Aeneas Williams. Maybe the cat's out of the bag with Jaden Thomas. It is a really, really difficult matchup for any team in the country. The only team that has scored more than 17 points against Ohio State is Oregon twice. They had 21, which were garbage points in a blowout Rose Bowl. And then, of course, the 32-31 game. Nobody else has scored more than 17 points against them.
Yeah, I think it's and this ties in a little bit to the last question. As much as you want to see Notre Dame have some chunk plays and get some explosives, unless that's early in the game and they go for touchdowns and you put Ohio State in a real predicament that results in some predictability, I think Notre Dame has to attack in a way that 3, 4, and 5 yard runs are real wins for Notre Dame on Monday night. Anything that mirrors the way it was able to stay on the field across the second half against Penn State, when it nearly exactly flipped the first half script, when Penn State was on the field for like 17-15 in the first half, and Notre Dame was on the field for whatever 11-45 in the first half, then Notre Dame had 17-20 in time of possession in the second half. I think time of possession Monday night is maybe the most significant in any game it's been all year for Notre Dame.
You look back at last year's game, there's two real reasons why Notre Dame held them to 17 and seven of it never should have happened. Number one, they're great on defense. And number two, Ohio State had 8 possessions. They had 12 possessions, you're done.
Yeah.
Like Georgia had 10 possessions that mattered. That's nowhere near Ohio State's offense, but that's part of it. But when you say, how does Mike Denbrock attack? I brought this up on a podcast yesterday. Tim, I'm going back to it again. When it's 3rd and 1 from midfield, I am taking a shot.
Yeah.
And then 4th and 1, I understand you want the ball. I get that.
And then 4th and 1, you go for it.
Yep. Or maybe 4th and 1, you take that shot too.
Like, that'd be,
I mean, back, I'm serious.
Back-to-back shots on 3rd and 4.
No, I know, at a different time. No, like at I'm a different time. Cool. Yeah. Pete wants 2 touchdowns, 50 yard drives. You know, you get 1, 4th and 1 from your own 50. You take a shot. Like you're getting a matchup. That's the way to get a matchup. That's the way Riley Leonard could look at one matchup.
Yeah.
Get the ball out. I just think I shouldn't have said perfect game. They have to do those things. You have to be like, they got him. Like this has been, they've been waiting on this and they got him on the wide receiver screens that I remember Tim Georgia game. I kept saying, quit throwing the ball horizontally.
Oh, yeah. Can't
go anywhere. That is fake it horizontal. And someone hits something, the release block. You need these in this game. My whole point is 4th and 1 at the 50, you get it. You have 49 more yards to go on the best defense in the country. So take your shot when you have a chance to take a shot. Cause you can't take a shot from your own 20 very easily.
Yeah, 33 and 44 at the edge are so good for Ohio State. You wonder if maybe some tunnel screens or slipping the backs, just having them rub in protection and then circling around over the middle of the field. You wonder if Notre Dame has a couple of opportunities to hit plays like that Monday night. I think those are the types of plays that Notre Dame will need to both loosen up that Ohio State defense and also – plant that in the backs of the minds of JT Tua Mulial and Jack Sawyer.
Maybe a shovel pass, and they haven't done a whole lot of that. If you get, you got to get through those two big defensive tackles to do that. But anyway, Pete, I'm sorry.
Let's get Leonard outside the pocket.
Doesn't trust his pocket right now.
Yeah, just get him outside the pocket. Pocket might not be great anyway. And just sort of like mess with the angles of Ohio State's secondary that way, about like how I'm covering you, like man, zone, like just give Leonard a cleaner look down the field. And it's like, I probably mentioned Chris Mitchell's catch against USC way too many times, but like that kind of play where it's just like, he's outside the pocket, he's going to scramble it. Oh, I just threw it for 15, 17 yards down the field. Like that's down the seam. Like that's the kind of stuff that I'd like to see Notre Dame try against Ohio State.
Our next question is from accounting teacher, ACCTG Teach. We found some clarification. How has Ohio State fared against mobile quarterbacks this season?
Well, I think people are looking for answers there, and I'm not sure that it's going to come. The two most mobile quarterbacks that they faced, of course, is Gabriel from Oregon and Ian Maleva from Tennessee. And it doesn't really show a whole lot. The first game when Oregon won in Eugene, Gabriel ran four times for 32 yards. He had a rushing touchdown. Ian Maleva carried 20 times. There were sacks involved here.
Yeah,
20 times for 47 yards. So, you know, he had some productivity in there.
He had like 86 yards rushing.
With all the negative yardage. And then in the rematch in the Rose Bowl, Gabriel was sacked eight times and, for 43 lost yards. So it almost doesn't really matter what they have or haven't done against running quarterbacks. Riley Leonard has to run. I mean, it's got to be a significant part of what they do. And I agree with Pete. I mean, I think it's some stuff outside containment, and not necessarily run it, but find that guy like Chris Mitchell, where you can dump it off. And Leonard's been doing a better job of that. He had one of those, I'm not sure which drive it was. It was a key one in the second half where it looked like he was going to run, and it was a third and three, and he dumped it to Greathouse and moved the chain. So I think it's important to get him on the edge, not necessarily just to run it all the time, but to still keep the RPO alive.
And Ian Maleva ran more in that playoff game than he ran in any other game this season. He's not really a dual threat quarterback in the mold of a Riley Leonard. He only had 358 net rushing yards total on the season, even with that playoff performance. And so that just wasn't a huge part of his game. And I also think that as good as Ohio State's defense is, some of those numbers against the throw game are a bit obscured because Michigan doesn't believe in the forward pass, or didn't this past year, and still found a way to win that contest. Dylan Gabriel in Oregon obviously did, and they had much more success in the first game than in the second game. But I do think that part of Ohio State's status as the number one pass defense is a direct result of the very poor competition that it faced in that regard, most notably an Iowa and a Michigan. Northwestern wasn't particularly good in the pass game this year. Rayola showed a lot of promise, but he turned the ball over quite a bit as well. So I do think that, to your point, there are vulnerabilities in the third level of the Ohio State defense. You've got to loosen up the front seven enough that you can capitalize on what I see as some vulnerabilities in the back end.
Yeah, they didn't really play running quarterbacks either when you look through it. I mean,
you mentioned
Michigan, Indiana, and Michigan State and Iowa. You're not looking at running quarterbacks here. And then Gabriel, it didn't matter what Gabriel did in the second game because they were down by 100. You know what? If Riley Leonard's down 35 to nothing, he can run all over the place for Ohio State cares. That's what happened with Oregon and Dylan Gabriel. So I think Riley Leonard's going to be a different animal for them. I'm saying they're athletically prepared for it, but it's a really interesting thing that John brought up about, I always talked about, like Notre Dame didn't play a good quarterback until week 12 either, other than Tyler Shook. So both, I think maybe you have to have you don't want to play the seven best passers in the country to have the number one passer rating. I think Ohio State and Notre Dame are, Ohio State's secondary has advantage on Notre Dame's receivers and passing game though, is the issue. And we have to see if Notre Dame's secondary can get out there and mitigate Ohio State's big plays and, of course, scoring plays.
Yeah. Hey, that was something I wanted to mention about my conversation. Well, and that's for another time. Anyway, sorry. We move on to TK Browns. Will Ohio State copy the USC offensive game plan, given that USC had the most offensive success against Notre Dame and Ohio State has similar offensive talent to USC?
I think that Ohio State is vastly more talented than USC at the wideout position. And I think overall that Ohio State has a better O-line and definitely better running backs than USC. I will note, interestingly enough, as I've talked to people in and around the program this week, Notre Dame very strongly believes that it faced a pair of much better tailbacks last week than what it will face this week against Ohio State. They respect Judkins and Travion Henderson, but they don't think they're as good as what they face last week in Singleton and Allen. So Jaden Maiva is inaccurate as he oftentimes was, I think probably has a little bit more arm strength than Will Howard. But yeah, I could see that. I can see the attack being similar, especially if Notre Dame is no more successful getting pressure on Howard than it was on Maiva. And then when they tried to dial up the pressure on Maiva to start the second half, that's when USC hit a bunch of underneath stuff and some crossers. And you don't want Carnell Tate and Emeka Abuka and four running crossers on your defense. I don't care how much faster Notre Dame is defensively.
I think, Tim, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just thinking back to the previous question. Drew Aller had success running against Ohio State. I just want to throw it in there. You know why? They didn't care. Like, that was Drew Aller escaping right. A few times for runs. It's just, it's a whole new ball game with Riley Leonard. That is the game plan, is Riley Leonard.
Yeah, we got to remember that. I mean, USC lost Woody Marks real early in that game. And so they were not in the position to run the football like Ohio State is. I mean, with Henderson and Judkins healthy and going into this game. Yeah. So I don't know that, you know, I don't think Ohio State's going to say, okay, USC did this, so we're going to do that. I just don't look at this the same thing. Ohio State's going to do what they like to do, and that is to strike a balance between their pass game and their run game. And they, you know, they have great receivers, but they're like 26 in the country in yards passing per game. They still want to run the football with two really good running backs. And again, that's where Notre Dame, despite Notre Dame not having three of their four starting off defensive linemen from early in the year, they've got to find a way to take advantage of an Ohio State offensive line that has really been, they've been inconsistent. They were inconsistent against Michigan. They were inconsistent against Penn State. They left points on the field against Texas because of penalties. So Notre Dame has to find a way to, I'm changing the subject there, but I just wanted to get that thrown in there.
Yeah, I don't think it's a game plan thing per se, but like USC made a lot of progress throwing outside the numbers on Notre Dame. And I think Ohio State will try to do exactly the same thing. But that's just basic offense. When you have guys who can win on the perimeter, and Ohio State has more guys who can win on the perimeter than anyone Notre Dame's played this year.
All right, quick answer here, guys, from Maltese Irish. Quick hit. What positions would you like to see Notre Dame still target in the spring portal? Tim, I know who. Why don't you start that?
I'm still on defensive tackle.
I thought you were on tight end.
Tight end's important, but it's a backup tight end. You know?
Yeah.
Tight end would be my other one, because the loss of Flanagan and the loss of Sherwood and the loss of Evans means you would have to beg, you'd have to like have Bauman back for your third tight end for a sixth year. That's, you need a tight end, I think, at this point, because Bauman could come back and be your fourth tight end. That's a great idea. But to have Bauman, you know, it would be a tight end would be nice. The problem is there's going to be defections, and we're going to have to answer this again in 10 days because we don't know what wide receivers are leaving and what running backs might leave and all that. That's running back is probably not one of them, but you know, you could have some running back leave that matters.
They should have grabbed Kevin Bauman's brother, Alex Bauman, who transferred from Tulane to Miami. That could have been helpful.
I kept Kevin Bauman for another year too.
Yeah, that would be fine. I would, you know, it's another defensive lineman. I'm not even sure I'd be too particular about whether it was an edge rusher or an interior guy or a run stopper or a pure speed. Like, just an, another body for that room. Because God knows we've seen this season and every season that room gets picked apart by injuries through the course of the fall.
Well, that's true. I think Jared Dawson is going to be really good for Notre Dame. Elijah Hughes is still a project, but he's got a lot of tools. But they're going to need him to. I mean, if you look at the depth chart, you look at who's a defensive tackle, he's a guy that you probably need as your fourth tackle. And as Pete just said, I mean, attrition along the defensive line is always when you can get rolled up and all the things that can happen in there. So I'm
let's make him the fifth tackle. That's my how I'm going.
That would be that would be and they have him for 2 years. John, you have anything you want to?
Well, real quickly, I wanted to piggyback on the last question because you're talking about some of the mistakes that Ohio State made, and they only averaged 4 penalties a game in their first 14 games, and then they had 9 last week against Ohio State. So if you're Notre Dame, you want to try to figure out a way to inflict more of those self-inflicted wounds on Ohio State. To have 9 penalties, I think, for 75 yards, that's significant. As it pertains to the portal, if you only gave me 2 choices, both of my choices would be D-line, particularly one more in the interior and someone else to supplement the edge, because, you know, Bubakar Traore and Jordan Bitello are both going to be coming back off significant knee injuries to open the fall. And then if you gave me a third choice, I'd probably go at wide out again, just because, you know, Malachi Fields doesn't get here until the summer, I believe, and has some health stuff he has to clean up in the meantime. So, yeah, that would be the 3 for me.
Question from Perm. What percentage man versus zone coverage has Notre Dame played all year? Seems to primarily be man from my view, but curious what reality is. Tim, do you have an exact number? I mean, it's Pete well into that. You got that? You have that, Pete?
I do not have that in front of me, but I want to say it was like in the 55% most of the season, man.
We saw it way earlier in the year, Pete, like late October, right? When we saw that and we were, but I'm sure it didn't change that much.
Yeah, which was way up there. Here it is. Earlier in the year, this was actually at the end of the season. It was 56.6%, again, behind only Purdue. Which just ruins everything.
But Purdue played man with only one safety. That's the problem. No, it's you're not allowed to do that.
Question from Sully Patrick. 1 week from now, what will the news be regarding coaching changes and players entering the transfer portal?
Voluminous? More? I don't know. It's going to be more than what we've had so far.
Pent-up demand.
The pent-up demand will be satisfied. How's that?
Yeah, I think when you look at Ohio State, there are real questions about the hierarchy of their coaching staff. There's been a lot of whispers that Ryan Day, particularly if he wins a national championship, will get some NFL looks, and that he would be willing to entertain those more so if he does. I think I've been told that Chip Kelly very much eyes a return to the NFL as an offensive coordinator. I was had that point hammered home to me this week in Charlotte by somebody very, very close to Chip Kelly, who spent multiple seasons working with Chip Kelly, a good friend of his. So I think he very much eyes a return to the NFL as an offensive play caller if the right fit is there. And if Kingsbury gets a job as a head coach, I think Chip Kelly could be a natural fit for the Washington Commanders. I'm quite certain he interviewed for that job last year. I think Al Golden, based on my talks in Charlotte, will absolutely have decisions to make about the NFL.
And then Mike Mickens, either. Of course, a lot of that would depend on Golden, but I mean, Mickens, one way or another, I think is going to get interest as a defensive coordinator, whether it's Notre Dame or somewhere else. And if Golden leaves, and it's probably Notre Dame, would you say he would probably become the coordinator?
I don't think I would say that.
Okay. You don't?
I don't.
I'm going to say yes, just like the over 1.5, Pete. Well, that's not there.
I mean, to me, that's why I always get back to because they're great.
Actually, I don't want that bet to ever happen. I want Al Golden to be the defensive coordinator for another team. And Mike Mickens be the right where he is. It's perfect.
Given the way that Marcus answered that question, that I wasn't even necessarily really asking about Mickens as much as I was asking about how he empowers his coaches. But given the way he answered that question a couple of weeks ago in New Orleans, if If there's a vacancy atop the hierarchy of Notre Dame's defense, I would be very surprised if Mike Mickens wasn't at least elevated to co-defensive coordinator.
And Pete, what makes you?
Just that's what I've heard.
Okay, I was gonna say. I was gonna. Somebody
he's
asked.
He's not just randomly throwing one out.
Yeah. No, I made a cut. I don't even remember what the topic was, and the guy says, "Well, why would you say that?" And I'm like, yeah. "I don't understand. I don't understand your question. What do you mean?
I don't. Why do you think that? We say things we say? We're not just pontificating the whole time, yeah. Unless it's a game prediction. For God's sake,
why would you say that? I don't understand your question. Yeah. Question from Irish Dodge. Other than fate, or it was meant to be. Are there any rational reasons to pick Notre Dame to beat Ohio State?
Yeah, I mean, you can bother Will Howard. I think I'm just going back to what Bryce said, and I've said it a few times. This isn't Clemson 2018 or Alabama 2020. Ohio State's been the best team most of the year. When they look good, they look the best by far, but they don't always come close to looking their best. So the one thing I'll say is, and I think I said this to everybody, I thought the semifinal was the time to get them coming off their role of how well they were playing. I thought Texas was the best chance to get them. But I mean, Notre Dame can get them too. I'm just saying that like that was the time for them to have to regroup and keep at the highest level. They didn't elevate, as Marcus Freeman would say, going into the semifinal. You know, now they have another chance to elevate. So I mean, Will Howard, if you bother Will Howard, he's incredibly human as opposed to Trevor Lawrence. If you bother him, he was just going to beat you anyway.
Yeah, I think I enumerated earlier all the reasons that I believe Notre Dame could win this game, and it starts with, you know, a 7-0 lead against a just miserable Iowa team and losing to a very pedestrian, and that's an insult to Crosswalk's Michigan team. And, you know, the other struggles that this Ohio State team has had at times. I think that Notre Dame has to find a way to damage Ohio State's confidence early, because as much belief as Notre Dame has right now, I think Ohio State probably has more for the way that it is playing. The best time to have gotten Ohio State would have been had Ohio State been the 9 or 10 or 11 or 12 seed somehow in this playoff, because they had dropped that late season game to Nebraska or to Indiana or whomever it was. So but it's not impossible. There's nothing about this that makes me say it's wholly impossible for Notre Dame. It just takes a complete performance, and we'll dive more into the things that I think must happen for Notre Dame to win, I'm sure, when we pod on Sunday.
I think there's plenty of good reasons to think Notre Dame can win. I mean, and one of the biggest ones is like, if this game is tight in the fourth quarter, who's going to play loose? Who's going to play tight?
Right. It's like the IU game when we said if Notre Dame is close with IU at home in the fourth quarter, that's going to be terrible, because you know who's going to be the pucker factor.
I think, look, and Notre Dame has shown twice that they know how to like drag Ohio State into an ugly football game. So there's ample precedent that they could do that. And if they do that again, I think Ryan Day is going to look across the sideline and like maybe he'll see a mixture of like Lou Holtz and Jim Harbaugh over there and just like just tense up. I could 100% see that happening if the game's tight.
Yeah, I think like if you're talking about head coaching decision making, I will take Notre Dame's head coach over Ryan Day. Now things get evened out a little bit in the coordinators, because I mean, there are a whole bunch of good coordinators in this game. But I go back to, can Notre Dame hold Ohio State to 20 points? Maybe they won't, but they could. And if you hold them to 20 points, 21 wins. So I think there are, I do have a little bit of it was meant to be feeling about this, because it's been 23 games since Notre Dame played Ohio State. And that was a game that Notre Dame should have won. And this is Marcus Freeman's alma mater. So if we're going to throw in the fate or it was meant to be categories
it's
into
the
this
third year, Tim, you're leaving off the every coach the wins third in his third year. Okay.
It's the third year. Yeah.
Except for ones that don't.
Notre Dame's got some magic to them. Why not? You know, why not? Other than, again, it could be like you were feeling, Tim, at the end of the first half against Penn State, like, okay, they finally reached that point. Ohio State is certainly an opponent that can make you feel like, okay, Notre Dame just can't take it any further.
I felt that way before the Penn State game. At the first half, I loved the field
goal. That's right. Okay,
yes,
that was me.
I want to make
that
sure that's clear. Yeah. I thought they are good, man. It's incredible. It's only 10-3.
Okay,
and Marcus Freeman used my quote. Yeah.
Before the field goal, I don't think anybody's feeling very
good. No. In fact, I said if he misses this field goal, the game's over. So that was a big deal. But that was worth more than 3 points.
Question from C. Domer. Notre Dame wins the championship on Monday. What's the storyline?
God, that's. I mean, like what happened in the game?
Well, I think a lot of the stuff
are we talking about where the Marcus Freeman statue is going?
In place of the one that they were going to put up for Brian Kelly. Oh, that's right.
You said it.
Nope. There's no mythical place to put it on campus.
Yeah. Thank you for hanging a lantern on that, Tim Priester. I just think it would be one of the great college football stories ever.
That's
it. I mean, just that. It would cap like the greatest. I mean, if you're I'm writing a story for tomorrow where I've talked to Notre Dame fans who are like going to all four games. Like,
I got a lot of people in that storyline. I think.
Yeah. What a month!
Yeah,
like this doesn't get any better than that.
If they were to win this game, they would win three quote major bowls in 3 weeks. Which they hadn't won in 31 years.
Yeah, on top of the IU game, which like when you talk to Notre Dame fans, say that often they're like, that was the greatest home atmosphere I've ever seen.
Yeah, that is the overwhelming sentiment that I've gotten. And I raised it to someone. I said, okay, Ohio State 23, ignore the result. But that was the first that Notre Dame kind of tried to do the more light show and have in-game stuff. And they're like, yeah, that was pretty close, but IU was better. IU was special. Somebody told me he'd been coming to games since the 80s and that IU was hands down better. He had been at some of those fantastic 1990s matchups through the years, including like the game of the century. And this was his favorite. So it has been remarkable from the atmosphere there to the teams that they've beaten in the two subsequent contests since then.
Didn't somebody say before that IU game, this is going to be the biggest game in Notre Dame Stadium since 2005 and it's not close? I'd like to go ahead and point that out. That was on this podcast because that was an unreal. It's an elimination game, for God's sakes. You lose in October, you just keep playing. This is storyline, and I was on Locked On Irish yesterday with Tyler, who does a great job. Is it the biggest win in Notre Dame history? And I said yes. I said it's bigger than the Sugar Bowl win over Alabama to cap the 1973 season because you just won four playoff games.
The magnitude of it, the way... Well, this kind of blends into the last question, which I'll go ahead and throw in there now. We'll just continue
to
talk about
it. 35 years removed from a title. You were 7 years removed from a title in 73. You were 4 years removed from a title in 77. Like,
no, nothing compares to it because you beat Indiana, Georgia, Penn State, and Ohio State. Nothing can possibly compare to that in the history of college football because of the 12-team playoff. And Martin Evenflow asked, what would it mean? And this is our last question. What would it mean for all of you who cover this program if Notre Dame wins the national championship? I think for Tim and myself, it's more personal than it is for Pete and John because we grew up in South Bend. And I mean, it would be like, I know I'd be very emotional after the game if it happens. Emotional. I mean,
It would be something that I just never thought I would cover. Honestly, like I just never thought it would happen.
Especially when they went to 12.
Yeah,
I mean that makes it so much.
I don't think I've ever said that out loud, but like I'm saying out loud, I didn't think Notre Dame was ever going to win a national championship.
I have said that out loud. Okay. I didn't think will Notre Dame ever win a national title? And I was on the side of a greater chance of it not happening.
Yeah.
And they may not, and it may be, you know, we don't know when they'll get another
post game, right?
Yeah. I mean, we don't know. Yeah. We'll go walk all over these comments, but you know, if they don't win, who knows when.
No, but they've had a wonderful run. The run is part of it. The run, like Pete's story. I know you've talked to some of my friends for this. The story is amazing. The story is absolutely remarkable that it started the home game everything about it, the New Orleans part, the Sugar Bowl is another part of the story that people had to fly home that flew in for the Sugar Bowl and had to fly home and not go to the game. You know, people had to do that. That's insane. Those people still got on a plane and went to the Orange Bowl and they're getting on planes to go into Atlanta. This is the best run as a Notre Dame fan you could have. It's remarkable. I don't know what's close to this one. I mean,
Nothing is close because nobody beats Georgia, Penn State, and Ohio State.
You played Miami of Ohio 12 times in the regular season. You still beat Indiana, Georgia, Penn State, and Ohio State to win the championship. It's incredible.
I mean, and even Ohio State
would
be able to make the same claim. They had open with Tennessee.
Their revenge tour, they lost to Michigan in a bad, there was a 20, I always give Ohio State grace because Michigan's Michigan, and I think Will Howard, once he got hit in that game, looked over and was like, it's not really that comfortable playing football anymore. But it was a 23-point spread. And they lost that game, but they bounced back from the hatred to get here, too. That's impressive, too.
John, jump in here, John. Oh, you're on mute.
That hatred fueled them. Ohio State, they just only had 3 weeks of it. Whereas, it's so fresh in the minds of Notre Dame's players after visiting with them last night, the utter disgust and contempt they very clearly felt on their own campus after losing to Illinois. And I think that's very much been a part of spurring them along. I thought Riley Leonard's answer to my question about how, we have guys talking trash about team success and other teams have players talking trash about their draft stock. I thought, and Drew Mintock did a great job of tweeting out that quote last night as he worked through some of the material for some stories he's doing for Irish Illustrated. I thought that was particularly telling, but this has been a phenomenal year. I've been doing this for 2+ decades. And now I've gotten to, over the course of my career, cover games in the original Orange Bowl, the original Cotton Bowl, the Rose Bowl. I got to add the LA Memorial Coliseum this year, Sugar Bowl, Orange Bowl. It's phenomenal. It's the stuff you don't ever expect to get to cover because college football is so beautifully unique that so much is happenstance every year. And then you see again that this team has had to overcome so much, particularly on its defense, but also its offensive line. And again, it's not just 4 significant guys out on defense, but it's 3 of those 4 being NFL players, absolute NFL players. And there's not a chance in the world that Ben Morrison and Boubacar Traore, as long as he comes back healthy, and Riley Mills are not NFL players. And Jordan Botello will probably be an NFL camp invite. So, I told Mintock last night, if Notre Dame wins, then you start thinking about parade coverage. And I jokingly said, good Lord, how many overtime lives is Priester going to want to do if Notre Dame wins this game?
I'm glad Bryce brought that up. I want to ask Pete and Tim that, because you guys, Pete, you've lived here for 24 years, and Priester for much longer. One of the reasons I was asked a couple times, I don't remember what show it was on, how Marcus Freeman is viewed. I said, he is been accepted, this team, this particular football team, and Marcus Freeman have been accepted by the local fans well more than anybody since Lou Holtz. And I don't think it's close. I don't think fans ever liked, and you might scoff at this, Tim, I don't think fans ever liked Brian Kelly. And I don't think fans like Charlie Weiss for very long either. And they definitely didn't like Bob Davey, and the Tyrone Willingham thing wore off in 2 months.
Yeah, well, I mean, the purple face.
Yes.
Brian Kelly,
opened 1-3 too.
That was the beginning of the end. And quite frankly, having covered Lou Holtz, there was always a faction that didn't like Lou.
They liked him a lot in 88 though.
Well, they liked him. Yeah. I mean, when he went from 88 to 93, they liked him a lot, but there was always a faction that, he runs the ball too much and this and that. Marcus Freeman just has this personality, especially during a run like this.
And he had to get past 2 months of Northern Illinois first to be totally embraced. But I feel like this last 2 months has embraced the program's football team and Marcus Freeman, not even close to anything else.
Yeah, because of the 12-team format that has allowed him to to accrue love at love showered upon him at a rate that never could have happened before.
Someone put it, I kept writing about Notre Dame with the most wins ever and the most whatever. So I was like, you got to quit comparing it to the 1966 team. I go, well, they won more games because they had to play 5 more hard ones or 4 more hard ones. They deserve the credit for beating these teams. Yeah. They deserve all the credit they're getting. It's an amazing run for Notre Dame.
And if they can I mean, I'll be outside my mind.
Just not during the game, Tim Priester.
No, not during the game. Because, you know, Pete, I was really good last week. Okay. Tim?
I have to confirm this with O'Malley in the media hospitality suite.
I was really good. But this one would be, I mean, this one would just mean, it would mean a ton. So we'll wait to see if that actually happens. But I have mentioned this. We are attempting to do a live stream from the Westin Peachtree Plaza, which is where the media hotel is. We want to do that on Sunday, the 19th. We're still trying to work out the logistics. If not, we'll have our Jack. You'll be available, correct? If not, we'll Jack, please. You'll be available for a regular podcast. We don't pull Jack, this up. Oh, yeah, appreciate that. One way or another, we will be coming to you from the Westin Peachtree Plaza before Notre Dame takes on Ohio State on Monday. So until then, Tim Priester, Tim O'Malley, John Bryce, and Pete Sampson, this has been Irish Illustrated Insider.